This episode is brought to you by Essentia. A better you starts with better hydration. Essentia is on a mission to inspire people to do what matters most. Their proprietary ionization process transforms water from any source into ionized alkaline water, providing water that's 99.9% pure with a pH of 9.5 or higher. Essentia overachieving H2O, the number one ionized alkaline water. Shop now.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
Have you ever wondered what it's like to bite into Nerds gummy clusters? They're fruity. They're tangy. They're gummy. And they're crunchy. Nerds gummy clusters, a union of fruity sweet gummy and tangy crunchy nerds. Unleash your senses. Shop now at nerdscandy.com.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello and welcome to another episode on the New Books Network. I'm one of your hosts, Dr. Miranda Melcher, and I'm quite excited today because I get to talk to Stuart Lawrence Sinclair about his book, just out from Bloomsbury, as part of the Fabulous Object Lessons series titled Space Rover, which, as all the books in the series do, does essentially what it says, investigates, in this case, the space rover. But there's a lot going on here. This is not a sort of technical manual book that says the wheel goes here and it does this. There's actually quite a lot more going on. So, Stuart, thank you so much for being with us on the podcast.
Thanks so much, Miranda. I'm really very excited to be here. And I think you just set up the book better than I ever possibly could.
Well, I'm glad we're off to a good start. To continue that, could you please introduce yourself a little bit and explain why you decided to write this book, Space Rover?
Sure. Okay. So I'm Stuart Lawrence Sinclair. I'm a writer and a journalist for the Anthropocene Alliance. And I also used to be a professional juggler. So I came into writing by way of juggling. And I mentioned that because it was in writing my last book, which was called Juggling, that the idea for Space Rover came up. And it was sort of in looking at how basically that was happening during the pandemic. And I was writing this book that explored my life in a certain lens, which was kind of the circus side of things. But there was always another side of what I wanted to do in my life when I was young. And that was I wanted to be an astronomer. And I was really interested in space. And I had a mentor who was an electrical engineer who worked for JPL. And so that had always been in the background of my life. And I had a friend who was an editor at Bloomsbury, who I've always wanted to pitch an object lesson book to, and his name was Chris Schaberg. But I never knew what object I wanted to write about. It actually is a very hard thing to come up with that topic. And during the pandemic, we were watching the launch of the Perseverance rover. So they sent that to Mars in 2020, 2021. And this was like this major attempt to do something under all those pressures of the pandemic. And as I was watching that go up, it just hit me that Rover was the object I wanted to talk about. And it took me back to this moment in 2017 when my hometown caught fire during the Thomas Fire. At the time, it was the largest in California history. It was over a year later, there was a bigger fire, and that's sort of the way of things now. But this happened in Ventura, California, and my uncle's farm, his ranch, ended up getting caught in the fire. And although his house was safe, everything in the barn burned down pretty much except for a box of photographs in the corner. And in that box was photos of his father, who had worked on the original moon rover. And these were pictures of them working on the prototypes and in the lab and out in the field. And this idea of like what survives a climate crisis, what survives a fire, what's left of civilization after we've destroyed ourselves, those kind of became questions that were bouncing around in my head. And they sort of converge with all the questions that people have been talking about lately of, you know, Elon Musk saying we need to have a planet B in case something happens to Earth. And so it became this question of what, why do we explore other worlds, and what is our responsibility to the world that we currently live on? And the only one that I think is going to be able to support human life for the foreseeable future. And so the book kind of explored, I think, that question mostly, and tried to make this call for the aspirational side of space exploration, but also the fact that you can't do that at the expense of caring about the problems we're facing on Earth.
All right. Having read the book, I agree that all of those meta points are very much there, and we're going to discuss them. But I guess I have a kind of pedantic or maybe like too obvious place to start before we get into those, to make sure we kind of are all on the same page to have those conversations in this context. Mm-hmm. So I have to ask, what actually is a rover? How might we define it? And to what extent are space rovers kind of a specific special kind of space technology?
Sure. So, you know, in one of the early chapters of the book, I make a point of saying that there is no such thing as a space rover. And that's, again, kind of a pedantic point in itself. But if you talk to people who work on these machines, they would call them planetary rovers or just rovers. And Bloomsbury really liked the name space rover because I think it just conjures up this image of sort of sci-fi robots roaming the solar system. But to me, I think that when I think of what a rover is at the technical level, it's a machine that either assists humans in environments that are inhospitable to us, or that goes to those places in our place. So for instance, the Moon Rover was a vehicle that allowed astronauts to actually explore the moon much broader than they would have without it. I mean, Neil Armstrong, he, I think, ventured maybe like 600 feet or something like that from the lander when he landed on the moon. And compared to that, you know, the other rovers, I believe, traveled something like 17 miles because they had that vehicle with them. And that really makes the scientific part of the mission. And that's what a lot of the people in those later missions will tell you. But in another sense, beyond the technical side of things, you know, a rover is a wanderer, and a wanderer is basically the same thing as the word for a planet. A planet comes from the Greek word to wander. And so in this book, I look at rovers both on Earth and in space as these vehicles that are exploring frontiers or the unknown. And that can range everywhere from being thinking of ancient societies who got onto catamarans and traveled across the oceans to our own explorations of space or traveling to the Arctic. So to rove is to wander. And I think humans are inherently that too. And these robots kind of are both a technical way of doing that, but also an expression of our desire to wander and to see the unknown.
Mm. And so is that why you think this particular object, to use the series title, gives you such a good lens to ask these meta questions you mentioned earlier about kind of why we explore and where and how we should explore?
Yeah, I think that it's interesting because they don't all convey the same message. But when we And they don't all have an inherent message. But when we look at, say, I kind of have to put it into two camps. So you have really only one rover out in space that anyone has ever driven, and that's the Moon Rover. And in that sense, I think we as humans connect to it because, like, if you think about the LEM, the lunar module that actually lands on the moon, that object looks like a virus or some sort of insect, people have described it as. And it very much looks like a spaceship. And a lot of people will call it like the first true spaceship because it doesn't have to operate on Earth ever. By comparison, the Moon Rover, it's a GM car that's just built for space. It's at one point the most recognizable thing you can see. You look at it and it just looks like a dune buggy. And at the same time, you're looking at a dune buggy on the moon. So it creates a bit of a I don't want to say a tension between those two things, but it's kind of a head trip. And so when you look at it in that context, though, it's like when you look at these astronauts who are in these clunky big spacesuits landing in this insect-like vehicle on the surface of this world that's unlike anything we've ever seen, it's the moment they deploy the rover and start driving around on the moon that suddenly it becomes legible as human life, human exploration on another planet. And to take that a little further, when we get to, say, Mars, and we're looking at Perseverance or Curiosity or Sojourner, those become our eyes. And suddenly Mars becomes a place that we're seeing at that level of, when it came to Sojourner, you're looking at it like at a child's eye level. You basically land there and you explore this little patch of dirt around you and circle around and look at different rocks. And I think it's very easy for us to relate to that sense of exploration. Plus, I think NASA tends to take these objects and wants to make you feel like they are human. They give them, or not human, like they are relatable or conscious. So they give them the Twitter profiles and send updates out through that feel cheeky, or they will have them take selfies. There's all these things that we do with these rovers that are intended, like, both for reasons that are opportunistic, in the sense that if you make rovers really popular and relatable, you're going to continue to get funding for rover projects. But at the same time, I think there's just something inherently optimistic and relatable about these machines that we connect with the work that they're doing, with the wandering they're doing on other planets. They are, I think, as far as anyone in our lifetime is going to get to being on the surface of Mars, and in fact, may be the best way for us to feel that connection to another place. So I think it just touched something deep within ourselves about our urge to wander. And we can talk about whether that urge is inherent in humans or not. But I think when we see it in the context of people who love space and people who love this type of work, I think those people, that audience is particularly has adopted that fascination and that love and that belief in wandering and exploration.
Well, I want to ask a bit more about kind of where this fascination, as you said, comes from. There is, of course, the idea of it being inherent, but you also talk about in the book some kind of key cultural artifacts that give sort of the mass audience ideas about what space rovers could be or could do. You talked about one in particular that really stuck in my mind is Disney's Man in Space from as far back as the 1950s.
Yeah.
What sort of impact do you think things like this had on the cultural imaginary of the space rover and all these ideas of fascination you've just told us about?
Mm-hmm. So Man in Space is like a really funky series that I recommend people check out, because it's a time capsule, but also this time capsule that it's straddling a very particular moment, and it's created by very particular interests. So this is a show that's created in tandem between Walt Disney and Wernher von Braun. So you have, on the one hand, the creator of Disneyland, and on the other hand, the creator of the Saturn V rocket. But even when the show's coming out, that rocket doesn't exist yet. He's still blowing up missiles in Huntsville, Alabama, and has only recently left Nazi Germany, where he was building the V2 rockets that were landing all over Europe. And so when they make this series, it's both like it's von Braun attempting to kind of whitewash his reputation and introduce himself to the American audience as this optimistic space pioneer. Like, he's not even mentioned in the series as a former Nazi, of course, or anything like that. It's just a German rocket scientist. And then you take that Disney sheen and you create this image of what space can be. And the image that you get in Man in Space is based on practical, real technology. It's envisioned by von Braun and other scientists of the time. But it's sort of the version that says, what if we had all of the money in the world and we could just go out and create exactly what we want? And in their vision of that, the moon becomes a place where by the end of the decade, there will be a colony on the moon. And important to that colony are these massive multi-ton moon trucks that would support crews of astronauts on multi-year missions. And so I think where up to that moment, there was a lot of, I think, interest in space. That interest was basically a sci-fi fear of alien monsters type of image. There were certainly people who wanted to, who had practical visions of space. But in the public conscious, and particularly, I think, the American public conscious, I think space exploration was still more fantasy than reality. And Von Braun and Disney, they took that moment and said, we're going to show you the real fantasy of space exploration. We're going to show you a future that is technically plausible, even if like the way it would play out later would be much more restrained and confined and limited by budget interests, by technological limitations. But it gave that image to the public of this is what we think our future in space can be. And so people have a common language to talk about that and a common vision.
The longest field goal ever attempted is 76 yards. The longest field goal ever missed, also 76 yards. Why bring this up? Because knowing your limits matters, both when you're kicking a field goal and when you gamble. Betting more than you're comfortable with is like trying a 70-yard field goal. It probably won't go well. So set a limit when you gamble and stick to it. Want more helpful tips like this? Go to KeepItFunOhio.com for games, quizzes, and lots of ways to keep your gambling from getting out of hand.
That answer really reminded me of two other, in fact, aspects of the book. I wonder if you can speak to a bit more. The idea of kind of trying something out, putting something together, because it is realistic. It is possible to make a chair levitate in ways. But it also kind of then when you get the idea and actually put it into practice, like the reality ends up somewhat different than the initial plan. I wonder if maybe we can link that back to the work you talked about right at the beginning that was discovered in those photographs that, you know, almost magically weren't burnt in the barn, and the kind of collective effort that went into building a lot of these like real JPL machines. And maybe also your own experience, younger than that, working on the, I mean, I don't quite want to call them science experiments. That feels like underselling some of the ones you talk about. But maybe you could discuss that aspect of the book of the kind of, it is possible, but also what is it like to actually build some of these things?
You know, and I would call them science experiments, but like at the, and in the best way, I think that in researching the book, I learned a lot about the, about that process of, again, that initial vision. So if we're talking about rovers, we were really up until very close to when we launched Apollo 11, still envisioning ideas of moon trucks or MOLABs, mobile laboratories, that would be, again, the idea of that multi-ton massive rover that could support a team on this expedition as it trekked across the moon and Mars. They had ideas for both of them. But like, you know, budget constraints and all of those things made that not a possibility. One of my favorite quotes from a NASA administrator was, you know, NASA charged us with putting a man on the moon. He didn't expect us to get a car, give him a car when he gets there. But at the same time, there were people who believed that you did need that technology and or just also were invested in making it happen for just ambitious reasons. And so they were like, okay, how do we take the fact that we've been given really no money to do this thing? There's no space on the Saturn V rocket to put the truck, like those MOLABs, just for context. The idea of sending those meant that for every space mission, every moon mission, there would have been two Saturn V rockets, one for the crew and another one that would have brought up the truck. Because if you're going to bring that truck, the rocket equation would not allow you to bring people without building a much, much bigger rocket to carry that much weight. So through iteration and innovation and a confluence of different people's eureka moments, you end up with what becomes essentially an origami Jeep, this little foldable vehicle that they could fit into a triangular sector of the LEM. And that's an amazing thing to think that they took something as complex and as hefty as a car and figured out how to fit it on the moon. And in that process, they came up with innovations that we're seeing today. So, you know, the Tesla Cybertruck is a drive-by-wire truck, meaning it's not a direct mechanical way of moving the tires around. Well, the first drive-by-wire vehicle, and I welcome any scientists to reach out and correct me if I'm wrong about this history, but was the Moon Rover. So those innovations came from the need to make a light and compact vehicle, and that challenge, you know, was the mother of invention. As far as the experiments that I've been happy to be a part of, again, a lot of the book talks about my relationship with my mentor growing up, who was an engineer, Mr. Cooper. And every week I would go to his house and we would do different science projects. It started with just stargazing and the telescope that he had built. But from there, we built a hovercraft and a propeller-driven three-wheeled car that we drove once, but Mrs. Cooper said, "You're not ever letting Stuart on that again because this thing looks like it'll kill him." So it really went through this whole range of just following my curiosities. And I think that process of discovery and experimentation, it's not that, how would I put this? It's not that anything we did created some eureka moment. And the reason I say that is because I think of Mr. Cooper as an engineer, and there's a lot I've thought about of that difference between the way a scientist thinks, he was a scientist, but the way we think of like a science project versus the way we think of it as an engineering project. And in engineering, it's about how do you make a mechanical thing work? And the science on that may already have been like firmly discovered. Like we knew we could go to the moon, but you still have to figure out how to actually build the rocket. So the engineers are going to figure out how the mechanics of that work, while the astrophysicists are going to come up with the equations to determine the trajectory. I think what I learned through Mr. Cooper was when you have a question, when something when something in the world is bothering you, or you don't know the answer to it, you can explore the question. And in exploring it, you, one, are likely going to come up with an understanding of the truth behind it. So as an example, when 9/11 happened, there were a lot of people talking about, oh, well, you know, a plane can hit a tower, but the jet fuel can't melt steel. Well, one, there's a lot of reasons that that's just doesn't make sense as a scientific argument. Steel can melt and bend without having to melt, and then the tower can collapse. But just to take that back to me and Mr. Cooper, I didn't know how to answer that question. I didn't have that technology or have that background. And I'm like 10 years old at the time. So what do? We build a tower and we set it up so that we can apply heat to one of the top floors. And this sounds rather morbid, but we collapsed the structure. And in doing that, I was able to not rely on what somebody else was telling me about how all of this works, but to come to an answer empirically on our own. And I think that has led me to a more skeptical path in life. But that's kind of, I think, what the value and the benefit of it is. It's this approach to life that says, when things around you seem really confusing or big, or when you hear some conspiracy, there is a method, and it is the scientific method to approach that question and find an answer that and find the answer to the question, basically. So you don't have to lean into the conspiracy or say that feels like it makes sense. You could say, well, let's figure out how we can actually look at that problem and find the real truth to it.
Yeah, no, that really did make a lot of sense. I mean, I asked a pretty open-ended question, so fair enough. But I do think it's also worth mentioning to listeners that obviously what you and I are doing is in many ways a highlights version of the book. Mm-hmm. And so for anyone listening who wants more of these science experiment stories, let me tell you, they're in the book and they're pretty entertaining. So just to flag that before we move to the next meta question I'd like to ask you about. Mm-hmm. In that answer just now, a lot of what you were talking about kind of could be summed up in some ways as sort of see it for yourself, right? Mm-hmm. Don't necessarily believe everything you've heard. Actually go figure out, does steel melt? How does that work, etc.? But you also talk about in the book some skepticism around the idea that it'll make some sort of difference in the world if famous slash rich slash influential people do things like go up into space and see visually those, you know, famous images we got back from the first few astronauts about the Earth is kind of all one world and we are alone in space. And the mm-hmm. astronauts have talked about kind of how impactful that was for them to actually see it. Mm-hmm. And we have claims now about, well, if Jeff Bezos went up and saw it, maybe that would make a difference. Mm-hmm. Does the, if they saw it, they would believe it, translate to that level?
So, yeah, and just for that, that whole thing can be summed up as what people like to call the overview effect, right? Mm-hmm. Sense of once you arrive in space and look down, you understand the isolation and the fragility of Earth and see it as this beautiful thing that you need to protect and cherish. I think that there is a truth to if you go to space and see that, you will feel that. But my skepticism is that you have to go to space to feel that. I think there are definitely that for the astronauts of Apollo and the various Russian missions and missions from other countries that have come since. But I'll focus it a little bit on Apollo because they were the ones who expressed that sentiment in so much of the media that we read around the overview effect. Mm-hmm. And I think the thing for them was the intent of the space race was not really focused on looking back at Earth at all. And so at that particular moment, they were like, we need to get to the moon. We need to beat the Russians. This is a geopolitical conflict that we are trying to either bankrupt the other country or prove our superiority or have the high ground in case someone sets up nukes on the moon. We need it to be our nukes and not their nukes, or to set the precedent that there won't be nukes. But within all of that, the astronauts, they get there. And again, their mindset is just not thinking about that fragility. They're so focused that I would say that one of my favorite quotes that didn't make it into the book is that the Apollo astronauts memorized as much material as was humanly possible to fit into their brains to do what they did. And when you think of it that way, you think of them as kind of machine-like, like they are learning 1,000-step processes in order to fly these hardwired computer explosive rockets to the moon. And there's very little time in all of that for reflection. Often when you hear the astronauts talk, many of them are pretty like they're not the most like what's the word I'm looking for? They're not so verbacious. They're not really.
Yeah. They're not necessarily great talkers.
Yeah, it's like athletes after a game. You know, they're like, well, we ran the ball across the court, right? Like they just focus on the technique, and I think astronauts were quite the same way, and were pulled from this. They were taken from this pool of test pilots and military men, and they were all white men, and they all had kind of this like, this is our mission view. But then they get to the moon and they look back, and that's when they have these moments that are truly and deeply profound. And Jack Schmidt, I believe, was one of them. It might have been Jack Schmidt. Actually, it wasn't him. One of the other astronauts, though, becomes a painter later in life and paints all of these astronauts on the moon in his memories, because like the photography and the cameras that we bring there were capable of capturing something, but they miss things that are just ephemeral or innately human and have to do with the emotional aspect. And he wanted to capture that. So he painted one portrait in which the astronaut is just shimmering gold, because like that's how he felt to be on the moon, was just like out in the universe as this like golden like apparition. And another one had these visions of one astronaut who was very religious. And so the astronaut who became a painter wanted to capture that faith. And so he drew a painting of that astronaut kneeling and praying on the moon, which, again, isn't a thing that necessarily happened or was caught on film, but it was the way he kind of wanted the moment to be portrayed. And so just to take this back to the overview effect, I think astronauts in Apollo arrived at the moon and turned around and were surprised to see their humanity. And when we and the collective humanity of us all. And it really was, I believe, a mind-blowing moment for them and a transformational moment for humanity. But nowadays, when it comes to Blue Origins or SpaceX sending the wealthiest people into space, I just think that whether it's Mount Everest or the moon or the Titanic, when you just create a system that says you can, if you can buy the ticket, you can take the ride, and we promise you an epiphany, you're not going to get that. You know, you're going to get a long line of people going up to the peak of Mount Everest. You're going to be flight number 17 in an orbit around Earth. And, you know, if you had something profound, what I suspect is that experience was something you felt beforehand. You were probably primed to feel that already. And if you knew the overview effect existed, I mean, you can see that from a distance. And that's kind of one of the points about rovers and about they have offered that experience to people by vicariously going places that people couldn't go. If the salvation of humanity and our ability to resolve climate change is dependent on the right billionaires going to space, then we are screwed because we just can't send the right people. We're not going to send everybody. And it shouldn't be inherent to understanding that this planet is fragile. And I think most people will acknowledge that, and most astronauts will acknowledge that too. But that doesn't mean it wasn't important to have that collective epiphany for humanity. So we had it through the process of the entire space race and all of us looking back together. I mean, the original moon landing remains one of the most watched events in human history. And I think that was, you couldn't say that it was Neil Young's epiphany that made that important to the globe. It was, and this is another thing many of the astronauts would say, they recognize that they are not special. They recognize that they are experiencing space as an ambassador to humanity, as a person who just got lucky to be in that seat. Like, really, they, you know, in the very early space missions, they didn't even put windows on the rockets because they didn't view the humans inside as anything more but scientific experiments. They didn't initially think to bring cameras on these trips because they didn't think looking at Earth was all that important. They just wanted to know how the machinery works. And I keep saying they, and this they I'm referring to is NASA. Mm-hmm. And so everybody thought this was a secondary thing. But the moment it happened and the moment we all came to experience it, it became embedded in our collective consciousness. Sort of like Rachel Carson's Silent Spring opened up a revelation about what we could do to the atmosphere. And that was something that we now all collectively have in our sense of relationship to the Earth and to the other animals on it.
Hmm. So given this, then, kind of where we were then, but where we're at now, Are you optimistic about space and the potential for space rovers to allow this vicariousness?
So, yes, I do. I am optimistic about what space exploration is going to do for humanity and for the planet. But it's not because I think we're going to colonize Mars. I think when I think about the role that rovers are going to play, they are, as if we ever do get to Mars, which there are a lot of technological hurdles that people who like Elon Musk are kind of brushing off in what I interpret as the same sort of like bravado that you'll hear from Ringling Brothers or from Walt Disney. This idea that you know, well, we just need to press ahead, and it's so urgent that it has to be possible. It's a bit of scientific utopianism. We think the answer to our problems on Earth are always someplace else. But I don't think that that's what space exploration is going to do for us. We go to Mars and we learn how a planet dies. in one way by drying up and freezing out. And then we go to Venus and we learn what it's like to have a planet experience a hellish runaway greenhouse effect. Every place we have gone to in the solar system has taught us something about Earth. Every time we have looked out into the universe, we have learned about Earth. Every technology that we've created for those purposes has been beneficial on Earth. And so if we were to just give up on that work, on that pure curiosity, if we were to give up on that work, whatever its purpose, because I mean, some people are interested in space from a military perspective. Some people are interested in space for an exploratory perspective. Some interested in space just because they like to see rockets go up. But whatever your reason for going there, the impacts have been tremendous for humanity. I was having this argument with my boss because they were a little skeptical about the impact of like that Earthrise photo or the overview effect. And to me, I'm like, that leads to the network of satellites that can track the clouds and the storms that are letting us know, and the temperature of the atmosphere and the temperature of the oceans, that gives us a high resolution view of what this climate crisis is. And I don't think we can solve it without that infrastructure. And I don't think we can solve it without that expertise. And that's, I would bet that on anything. So it's inherent that we keep doing this work. And if some people are saying we're trying to do it so that we can get to Mars, then that's fine, do it. But like, you need to continue in funding projects on Earth. But even those self-interested billionaire projects going into space are having spin-out effects for humanity that I think are beneficial. I think as much as I don't like Elon Musk's control over the satellite internet infrastructure and the fact that most satellites in space now are SpaceX satellites, I still think that having that infrastructure of a satellite internet that can be accessible anywhere on the planet is important and crucial. So I think it's always going to be a tension between why we're doing something and how it benefits us. Mm-hmm. So I guess I'm like technologically neutral in that way. Mm-hmm. And as far as rovers in particular, again, I just think they are more likely to continue to be in whatever forms they take, because they can take many, many different forms. They're going to continue to be our eyes and our ears. And as AI develops and the programming that goes into these rovers gets more advanced and the material science advances, they're going to be more capable of going more places. And humans will remain as limited as we are. We are bags of flesh and blood that will compress into pancakes at high enough G loads. So we will always be able to get to more places to learn more things through these robots. And we may even be able to have a more direct relation to those machines. By that, I mean, you know, take what we do with VR headsets or things like that. I think we're at the cusp of, and a very like messy cusp of that moment where we can have a more direct involvement with rovers to really see from their perspective, for them to be more autonomous in their movement so that they can explore more like humans and to have smarter brains that we may feel a little more connected to, which sounds a little creepy, but also, but I think that's the reality. If we want things that are like humans to move around on Mars, the smartest way to do that is probably to send some sort of humanoid robot to do it. Mm-hmm. Even though humanoid robots tend to be the least efficient ones. Hmm. So, yeah.
Well, some very interesting things to look out for in the future of rovers and space more broadly. So thank you for giving us kind of all those things to think about. If we stay on this topic of the future for my final question, what might you be working on now that this book on the space rover is out in the world?
Sure. So it's, you know, I would say that I've now written, this is my second book, the first one being, again, about juggling and my life in the past as a street performer. And now I've written about space rovers. And these were kind of the two twin paths of like other things I could have been in my life. So I think there was a legitimate path where I became where I ran away and joined the circus. And there was a legitimate path where I went and decided to become a scientist. And now I find myself in my day job as an environmental journalist, working with people on the front lines of climate change issues in the United States, which I find deeply rewarding. But like also that becomes one lens of my writing where I get to explore that scientific and journalistic side of what I do. And alongside all of these things, I've been working on a more traditional memoir that just deals with a blue collar family in California, being my family, trying to basically overcome the challenges of upward mobility in class in the United States, and overcoming struggles with a country that is increasingly making it difficult for people to obtain educations, to work to keep their families fed. I grew up in a house where it was very, again, working class, blue collar, single parent home. And I'm the first person in the family to go to college. And I've got four sisters and I love them all to death. But we had a challenging childhood with a lot of love, but a lot of hardship. And so the next book is the one I've been trying to write since before I started my first book. And that really is that more of a family saga of attempting to comprehend like that. What is that working class family in America?
Hmm. Well, definitely a big project, not something that can be kind of easily tackled. So very much best of luck with that.
Thank you.
And while, of course, you're working on that and your other work, listeners can read the book we've been discussing, again, titled Space Rover, part of the Object Lesson series from Bloomsbury. Stuart, thank you so much for being with us on the podcast.
Thank you so much, Miranda. I really appreciate it.